Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. On today's program, we're interviewing Ben Weber. He's the author of a terrific new book entitled People Analytics: How Social Sensing Technology Will Transform Business and What It Tells Us About the Future of Work. Ben, welcome to Edgewise.
Great to be here.
Your book strikes me as one of those transitional books that takes us from the people work management time card project world of the Dick Van Dyke era, let's say, or something like that, to a much more modern type of environment where technology, whether it's advanced use of email or advanced use of office space design or thinking about on-the-job creativity in a different way. And also this idea of, forgive me here, you're going to correct me when I say this,
sure.
but big data as it applies to people and the management or leadership of people. Am I wrong? Tell me whether I'm right or not.
So you have sort of all the good thoughts in there. I mean, I think the idea is that when you think about how we've managed companies, really up to now, it's viewed as a very soft thing, right? Even in general, you know, what is creativity? Well, you know, we've got some ways that we think we can get at it, or even productivity in a lot of fields. It's very hard to measure. And even when it is easy to measure, we tend to focus maybe on the wrong things. You know, at the end of the day, the reason that we form companies is because together we can do things that we couldn't do by ourselves. But at the same time, when we actually look at how we reward people and how we try to measure our own time, and also measure the time of people that we work with or work for us, we tend to focus on the individual. We tend to say, you know, what is the amount of stuff that you've produced? And the issue is that while obviously someone has to produce stuff at the end of the day, what you really care about is what the group outputs, what the company and the team outputs. And a lot of times it's very hard to figure out how much of a contribution you actually made to that end product. So the idea is that a lot of us hate interruptions. And we're sitting at our desks trying to get things done, and people are coming to us, talking to us, and it really makes it hard to get work done. And so we think that's a bad thing. And it can be a bad thing. But I would argue that if you're spending 2 hours of your day making 10 people 20% more productive, then that should be a huge part of your job. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, how do you quantify that? And how we've tried to quantify this stuff in the past is we either send out surveys, which we know what the problems are with surveys. If it's a sunny day out, then you'll answer differently than it's a cloudy day. And we're just also not that good at remembering these sort of interactions. If I ask you who you talked to yesterday, we're only about 30% accurate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can also try human observers. But again, we have issues of subjectivity, of scale. I can't look at 100,000 people. And what's also interesting is that we actually have data on these interaction patterns and these collaboration patterns, and we just haven't really realized it up to now.
So let's jump into this. And I think the two-part question I need to ask you to set up some of this, if you don't mind, is what should we measure and how do we measure it? Or how should we measure it?
Right. There's really a few big things that we should be looking to measure. In the book, I talk about this, but the idea is that we really want to understand how people are collaborating and how they're behaving at work. And so crucial to that is looking at who talks to who and how people talk to each other. Not what they say, but really trying to understand tone of voice, volume modulation, interruptions. Are you being interactive? Are you dominating conversations? These sort of things. And it's also something where we don't want to make this into measuring these things, you know, whether it's through human observers or using some other data collection methodologies like sensors. We don't want to make it into something that's Orwellian, where the company's watching where you are all the time. It's really something where there's actually not a good business case to look at what Bob is doing at 2:30 on Tuesday. Really what you want to understand is, what are the things that make people productive and happy? And how do I change the company? How do I change my team and myself to make everyone happier and more productive? And I guess when you think about what are the behaviors that go into that, again, I'm really looking at things like social network patterns. So looking at who's connected to who, but even looking at things like your posture. Am I actually leaning in when we're talking to each other? Are we getting engaged? Am I actually physically active? There's been a lot of work on how physical activity is important. And it's, again, something you should look to measure. And also, obviously, increasingly looking at digital communication, looking at who you emailing, how are you emailing people, who are you sending IMs to, how are you using internal social media, all these tools we have at our disposal, really trying to understand how all these different things contribute or don't contribute to the outcomes that we care about.
So they paint a complete picture.
Exactly. You're getting a holistic view, really, of what's going on in the company.
Okay. So here's the question I wanted to ask you from the moment I met you. What is the badge? How does it work? And what is it to the work that you do?
Okay. The way to think about the badge is that...
Incidentally,
yes.
Ben is wearing a badge around his neck.
Right here, I've got
right
it right around
now,
my neck.
It looks something like a cross between an ID card and an iPhone.
I think that's a good way to describe it. What's interesting is that when you think about what do we bring with us to work? Well, we have an ID card, we have a cell phone, and those are sensors. So most ID cards today have a little RFID chip in it. So it's a little radio. And that's what you use when you tap onto a door. That's what tells the door that it's you. And if I put little RFID readers in the ceiling, I could actually figure out where you are. Now, again, if I want to figure out, how you're collaborating with people, location by itself isn't that useful, and just tracking people around is a little bit creepy. So the question is can you do things beyond location that really tell you these other things you want to know? And it's interesting because you think about an iPhone, you think about a cell phone, they actually have also even more sensors than an ID card. So they'll have an accelerometer, which is a motion sensor, but if you're wearing it around your neck, you can also look at posture. It's also got a microphone, which you could record what people say, but you can also analyze the way people are talking. And those are essentially the sensors we put onto the badge, in addition to proximity sensors. So I can actually see how far away I am from other people, but also who am I facing.
So sort of my badge is close to your badge.
Exactly.
Kind of thing.
And also I could tell that I'm facing you right now versus facing somebody else. And when you have all these sensors together into one package, this really enables you to understand how people are collaborating face-to-face. Because that's the big part of the picture you're missing. It's very easy to look at digital data. I can pull email data, IM data, phone call data. All that's already digitized. But first of all, if we think about what's most important, really, what really predicts how creative you are, how productive you are, really face-to-face is the biggest predictor of that. And so you need to understand that. And you also need to understand that at a quantitative level and in a scalable way. And within 5 years, whether it's us or somebody else, these sensor badges, these sociometric badges that we've developed or someone else develops, they're going to become the company ID card. And we can tell you the ones that we've got coming down the pipeline are about the same size as an ID card. And so the question is, what can you do with that data? How does it really transform our understanding of ourselves, of our team, and really what it means to manage people? I think it's interesting that before we were doing this work, again, if I asked you, how much money does a company make when its employees eat lunch together? Like, how do you answer that question? There was just no way to collect that sort of data. Or if I asked you, what size lunch table is going to make people most effective? Again, it's this weird question, and maybe there's some ways to get at it, but it seems very difficult to get at and doesn't seem like it's very important. Mm-hmm. But once you start looking at this data, you start to sort of uncover the different levers that we have at our disposal to improve not only our own behavior, but also the people that are around us and the people that we work with. And I think that's what's really exciting about this technology is that as this replaces the company ID badge, we're just going to be able to be so much more data-driven and so much more effective when we talk about managing companies.
Well, this is interesting because, a good amount of historical work has been done in the measurement and observation of assembly line workers or plant workers or people who are far more almost machine-like in their behavior and their mm-hmm. expectations than they are as human beings. But what you're talking about is bringing us really into the realm of, again, the Drucker knowledge worker, the person who has to solve customer problems, innovate product ideas, follow a whole bunch of either government or company regulations. And there's all these abstract things that aren't as simple as make X number of widgets in a day. That's really what you're after there, isn't it?
Right. What's been really interesting is how much we focused in the past in management on these very measurable tasks, right? On, you look at call centers or you look at manufacturing. And those things are still important. What is also interesting is it turns out actually that collaboration matters there as well because of what I was talking about earlier. Because maybe my output isn't the best, but if I can help other people's output, even if that's not my job, then that's actually an important thing that I'm doing. But what's really important is that as we get more into knowledge work, it becomes harder and harder to collect these sort of metrics. So if I'm a researcher in pharmaceutical company, then once every 10 years, I'll come out with a new drug. But the rest of the time, the stuff I'm working on just never sees the light of day because it's very hard to predict beforehand what's actually going to turn into a drug. And so you think about the way we evaluate people in these roles now. And what happens is basically you ask the boss, you say, did this guy do a good job? And they'll say, yeah, sure, or no, I don't think so. And that's how we evaluate, that's how we promote people, that's how we pay people. And it cries out for a much more quantitative metric. And when you think about things like creativity, right? Fundamentally, what you care about is having these cross-cutting interactions where you're having in a pharmaceutical company, the guy working on the baldness drug talking to the woman working on the painkiller. You know, it doesn't seem like there's a connection there, but if they bump into each other, then maybe they get this new idea and that new thing can turn into the next blockbuster drug. So that's what you want to incentivize. And you can show over larger groups of people that those sorts of behaviors tend to be related to higher rates of innovation, to better products. It really makes something where you can say, not just that that predicts outcomes, but you can say, what are the things the company does, whether it's the organizational structure, the way the office is laid out, from something as simple as where the coffee machine is, that you can show how those things directly impact, for example, creativity. Before, if I wanted to say, let's increase creativity in my team, in one team, well, what does that mean? How do we do it? Again, there's a lot of qualitative ways we can try to look at that. But if I could measure it, I could definitively say, you increase creativity by X percent, and here's what it means for the company's bottom line. And I think that's a very, very exciting way to think about how we can manage ourselves.
All right. I can see that as being one of the arguments or one of the points you can make in trying to convince an old schooler about the advantages of your type of approach to this. But again, we're in a transitional era where I would imagine you've had a fair amount of conversations with people who need to be coached through the creepiness or the implied creepiness of this type of thing, of wearing a badge, of being monitored, of metrics associated with this type of thing. And how do you convince people? What do you tell them? How does this work?
There's a few principles that we adhere to. And I think that is the reason that we've gotten such buy-in from the people that we've worked with. So one of the crucial things is that when we deploy badges, we do it in an opt-in basis. So you don't actually force people to wear the badges. And people can even choose to wear badges that don't collect data, so dummy badges, so that no one knows they're not participating. First of all, one of the big ideas is that if at the end of the day, this technology poisons the atmosphere of the company, then it's defeated the purpose of what we're trying to do. But I can tell you, in the last year, we've gotten over 90% participation with every single company we've worked with. And one of the reasons is because we don't just come into a company and say, here, wear this, right? Because if you just come in with this badge, I don't know what it is. I don't think I would participate if somebody did that. But what you do is you come in and you talk about, this is the data we collect. Your name isn't directly stored in the database. Your company has no rights to your individual data. We're even going to give you a consent form. So we give out consent forms where we have the actual database tables of what we collect. And we sign it along with participants saying that we won't share their individual data. And so we're giving them as much guarantees as we can and being as transparent as we can in terms of what we do with the data. You do give feedback to these individuals though. So, you know, as sort of incentive for participating, you actually get to see, you know, where do you stack up compared to high performers or compared to the average? You get recommendations about what are the things you can do to change your behavior, to be more productive, to be happier, and all these things. At the company level, then you can see these metrics reported up at a more aggregate level. So we're not going to show you what Bob is doing, but we'll show you what this team is doing. Right? So you can't tell what a single individual is doing. At the end of the day, that's really what we care about. We care about how teams are working together. We care about the outputs at that level, because that's really where your contribution really starts to show. And again, you're rolling this out over approximately a four-week period. So you're letting people ask questions about it, get comfortable with technology, and we just show them results that we've gotten with other clients. And the key is, you know, people are worried about legitimate things. Are you recording what we say? And no, we're not doing that. Or can my boss look at my data? They can't do that. And then, you know, are they tracking how many times they go to the bathroom? And no, we're not doing that. Because at the end of the day, the most important things that are going on are your interactions with other people. And I can tell you that some of the most valuable time you spend in the day is by the coffee machine. And it's interesting because you think about, and I think one of the reasons people get really excited about participating is that a lot of times, you know, some managers will feel pressure to say, all right, you know, I see people are eating lunch in the cafeteria, not their desk. That means they're not busy enough. But no, actually, it's very important to have those interactions. I can show you that not just those individuals, but the entire team, the entire company is going to be a lot more productive if they're able to not only have work-related discussions at lunch, because that can't happen, but also more private discussions and personal discussions. Because again, if you're stressed about something at home, you're not going to be too effective at work. But also, if I get to know you at a very deep level, if I get to trust you, it's much easier for us to exchange, you know, complex information, sensitive information. And that means that as a unit, we can be a lot more effective. Really demonstrating the value of these things where a lot of employees sort of intuitively feel that they're important. They just had no way to demonstrate it before.
We've spent a fair amount of time talking about personal, face-to-face, coffee machine, water cooler, lunch table types of conversations. What about the virtual world of work? More and more people are involved in projects or working for companies that span time zones or cross over cultural barriers. What is your answer to that?
Well, we've done a lot of work, and in the book I talk about some of the work we did with IBM, looking at software development teams, which, if you know the software industry, it's becoming increasingly virtual, not just because you've got people in the U.S. who are working from different locations, but increasingly you have people from other countries. And of course, there's good reasons for this, right? Some of that is that you have people with different skills in different places. Some of that is, you know, for example, if I'm starting a project in India, I probably need a guy in India that's going to be working on this. But with these software teams, what's interesting is there's actually a lot of good data about how effective people are and how effective the team is. What we actually ended up doing was looking at how do people who are collaborating when they're co-located compare to people who are collaborating remotely. So we're looking at an entire development team, a couple hundred programmers. And what we did is we mined out all of the data from their development platform. So we actually saw not only who was talking to who, but also who was talking to who about which piece of code. Again, this is all digital. This is looking at email and IM. And from the code, we could actually see whose code depended on who else's code. And, you know, some of us might be programmers, but if you're not a programmer, you might have this sort of vision of this guy sitting in the corner drinking Mountain Dew and programming away and not talking to anybody. And that's what a programmer is. But actually, programming is this very collaborative task. And there's a lot of good work out of CMU and out of IBM as well that showed that if you didn't talk to the people whose code your code depends on, that's where the bugs happen. It's about 12 times more likely that a bug will pop up if you don't talk to those people, and it'll take you 32% longer to develop that code. So it's a really big effect. So what we did with IBM is we just said, all right, let's look at these developers, and we'll look at the communication patterns. I'm not even going to look at face-to-face, right? I'm not going to handicap people who are remote. And I'm just going to say, was there at least one communication about these software dependencies between people? And we'll compare co-located and remote people. Just so you know, it actually turned out there were more dependencies between people who were remote than there were people who were co-located. What was really interesting is if you look at that, across 55% of the co-located dependencies, they did communicate at least once about that code, whereas obviously 45% of the time they didn't. And that was essentially flipped when you look at remote groups. And so that translates into essentially about 4% performance difference between remote and co-located groups. Okay, which is actually very significant if you look at a lot of these things. For Yahoo, for example, when there's been a lot of talk recently about Yahoo's whole remote work policy, if you back out the numbers, for them, that would be worth about $150 million more in revenue a year. So very significant. But what was interesting is that was a very low bar. We were looking at least one communication. If you look at, on average, how much do co-located people communicate about a dependency, it was 32.5 times. Whereas for remote groups, it was about 8 times. Not only are they communicating less, just in terms of communicating or not, but also the actual number of interactions is significantly low. And what's interesting is that technologically, there shouldn't be a difference, right? It's technologically very easy for me to talk to anyone. I don't care where they are in the world. And so what this means is that as we get to have remote groups, we need to be a lot more proactive about communication. We can't just assume that the tools we have today are going to solve all our problems, because they don't. And that's what the data clearly shows. And there's a lot of good work at University of Michigan, for example, showing that when you have remote groups, if you get them together face-to-face at the beginning of the project, they work significantly better than groups that never meet face-to-face. And so, again, to the extent that you can get people together, not every day, because obviously if you're flying people together all the time, then they're not going to be very effective. But once every couple of months, getting people together in person is actually very significant and has ROI. And I think that's very important, because traditionally you think of flying people as a cost. But the point is that we're really missing the calculation there. We're really thinking too much about how much does it cost us up front versus what does it actually cost us in terms of long-term productivity.
It strikes me that a fair amount of what you're discussing here would make sense for a larger organization, a big company, where conceivably it would mean more data points for you to measure or more meaningful modeling to happen or whatnot. Can this type of thinking be applied to smaller or mid-sized companies?
Yeah, and actually we've done some work with mid-sized companies. And really where we see this going is obviously, as we've been growing, and the company that I spun off of this has been working a lot with larger Fortune 500 companies, what we're really doing is providing this as sort of a service that can apply to pretty much any type of company. The reason isn't just that the number of data points matter. It's actually that as we do more work in certain industries, we actually know what we should be looking for. So now we've done a lot of work in finance, for example, right? So even if you're a mid-size or small bank, I actually know what behaviors tend to relate to different outcomes. And then sure, to the extent that you can add your own productivity data to this, you just can improve those metrics. But I think where we want to go with this, and what one of the really big opportunities is here, because small businesses are such a huge part of the economy. But you think about it, a lot of small businesses fail pretty quickly. I think it's something like in three years, I think roughly 70% of small businesses fail. And one of the big reasons is that the people who start those companies, they've never run a business before. And I talk about it in the book. Imagine you're starting a pizza restaurant, and maybe I'm a really good cook, but I don't know. How do I train my wait staff? Well, I don't know. I mean, again, I have maybe some intuitions, but I could be right. I could be wrong. What if I could actually compare myself to the best pizza restaurant in the world? And I can actually see how do their wait staff interact with customers? And then I could see that. And then my wait staff could see how they compare to that and they could improve. And I could try to help coach them through that. And then it's something maybe where I'm not just learning from pizza restaurants or other restaurants in general. Maybe it turns out there's a small grocery store in Africa doing something very interesting organizationally that would apply to me. Because this data is being collected all the time and analyzed all the time, I could actually learn those best practices in real time. And eventually where it's going to go is to this thing where big companies are going to learn from each other, but also from small companies and vice versa. And you're going to have things where rather than, well, today, if you want to learn sort of best practices, right? The way it works today is get some professor who will write a Harvard Business Review case study, take a couple of years after it actually happens, and then it'll take a couple of years for that to actually enter organizations. So we're now 5 years past when it actually happened, at which point it's probably become obsolete. Now we're getting to something where literally the next day you could start implementing this stuff. And I think it's this very exciting time where across cultures, across industries, across sizes of companies, you're going to see this rapid exchange of best practices. And it's just going to make everybody a lot happier and a lot more effective.
Are we going to see examples of that in the workplace as well, where managers, frontline managers, people who are on the floor, people who are leading teams or call centers, they're going to be face to face with the issue, the challenge, the employee, but they're not going to be able to see the forest because of the trees?
Well, I think that's to a certain extent true today. You know, there's a lot of things that, sure, we do based on intuition, and sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. But it's very hard to have this perspective on all these different levers that we actually have at our disposal. I mean, a good example with that is, again, I alluded to it earlier. If I asked you, what's the optimal size of lunch table for, let's say, a software company? I don't know. What, there's no intuition there. Maybe you'd guess right, but probably you wouldn't. You would have just no idea what the right answer is. And it just turns out that as we were collecting data in this major online travel company, we weren't looking at lunch tables, obviously, at first. We were looking at how do people eat lunch? Do they eat lunch alone? Do they eat lunch in groups? And we saw it was interesting. The company would cluster very strongly into people who tended to eat in groups of 12 and people who tended to eat in groups of 4. And it was very consistent, and we couldn't figure out why it was so consistent until we realized that in the company cafeteria, there was one area closer to a few groups that had only 12-person tables and a different area that only had 4-person tables. And it turned out that the people at those 12-person tables were significantly more productive than people at the 4-person tables. Because if you looked at it over the course of the week, if I sat at the same lunch table as somebody, I was significantly more likely to talk to them. It makes sense. You eat lunch with somebody, you would still come to lunch in a smaller group, but you'd sit down, there'd be another group there, you'd start talking to them. And an online travel company, it's really helpful to have a global perspective on how your code fits into the overall picture. And also you just learn what other people are doing and maybe they can help you with a specific problem you have. But thinking of a lunch table as a management tool, as an important management tool, as something that gives you double-digit percentage increases in performance would have seemed crazy without the data. And I think that a lot of managers are attuned to some of these things, right? Like that it's important to let people eat lunch together or go to the coffee area. The degree to which we're now going to have control over this and understanding of it is just going to be orders of magnitude more than we have today. And really enabling not just the best managers to sort of have that ability, but really everybody to have that sort of insight and to learn from each other, I think is where this technology is going to be really exciting.
We've been speaking to Ben Waber. Ben is president and CEO of Sociometric Solutions, a management services firm that uses social sensing technology to understand companies' internal communication patterns and drive innovative transformation services. He's also author of a great new book entitled People Analytics, How Social Sensing Technology Will Transform Business and What It Tells Us About the Future of Work. Ben, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
We have a special gift for our loyal Edgewise listeners, a free copy of an ebook entitled AMA Business Bootcamp. In it, we have assembled the most critical must-have skills for managers and leaders. To download your copy, simply visit our website, amanet.org/bootcamp. That's amanet.org/BOOTCAMP. This free download will be available until November 1st, 2013. So get your copy now.
Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.